Good morning. It's 9:30 and the reading of the Green Valley News for Monday, February 16th. Mark DeGroft with you. Law enforcement officers swarmed a house on Friday night, less than 2 miles from the home of Nancy Guthrie, but in the end, nobody was arrested. Pima County Sheriff Chris Nano said those at the home on Camino del Michael, which is near Orange Grove and First Avenue, were detained while a warrant was served and the house was searched. Nano said there were no signs of Guthrie at the home. He said a traffic stop was made on Friday evening on a person of interest near a Culver's restaurant at River Road and First Avenue, and that person was cooperative and was later released. He reiterated what he said after Rio Rico man was detained and released last week. Moving forward, you'll probably be seeing more of these types of events. Reporters on the scene saw dozens of police vehicles, including SWAT trucks, in the Shadow Hills neighborhood. Agencies on the scene included the FBI, Suarita, Marana, Oro Valley, and Pima County Sheriff's Department. Earlier in the day, investigators announced the discovery of new DNA evidence at the Guthrie home, not belonging to Guthrie or any of those close to her. It was being tested along with several gloves that discovered as far as 10 miles from the Guthrie's home. The FBI also confirmed new details about the suspect after a forensic analysis of the doorbell camera footage by its Operational Technology Division. The suspect is described as a male, about 5'9 to 5'0" tall, with an average build. In the video, he's wearing a black 25-liter Ozark Trail Hiker Pack backpack. The FBI announced on Thursday that it had doubled its reward for information to $100,000 and is still seeking evidence footage and surveillance footage from residents within a 2-mile radius of the home. Since February 1st, the FBI said it has collected over 13,000 tips from the public related to the case. The man that has been accused of attacking a Sprouts employee, Random Cars, and his parents' home last year is now competent to stand trial. According to Pima County Superior Court records, doctors determined in October that Daniel Eugene Kovarik II didn't understand the nature of the charges that he faces and was unable to assist his attorneys in mounting a defense. Judge Mark Hotchkiss ordered Kovarik to go through Pima County's in-custody restoration program, where doctors typically use a combination of medications and education in order to help people regain their competency. On Monday, Hotchkiss deemed Kovarik competent and started the clock running again on his right to a speedy trial, according to court documents. In addition, the judge ordered medical staff at the jail to continue to give Kovarik his prescribed medications and then ordered Kovarik to keep taking them to maintain his competent status. A status hearing has been scheduled for March 13th. Kovarik, who's 42 years old, is facing charges in Pima County Superior Court, Suarita Municipal Court, and Green Valley Justice Court. According to authorities, on March 17th, dispatchers received a 911 call about a man standing on La Cañada Drive near the Duval Mine Road, swinging a bat at passing vehicles. While officers were en route, dispatchers received another call from somebody stating that when they tried to drive around a man with a bat, he struck the windshield and passenger door. Shortly after that, a third call came in stating that a man that was matching the suspect's description was damaging windows on a home near La Cañada and South Rio Altar. When Suarita officers and Pima County sheriffs arrived at the home, they did not find anybody. The Green Valley man, who was thoroughly convinced that the guy on the other end of the phone was an FBI agent, he knew when he banked and other personal information, and he trusted him. The elderly man had no reason to question the agent when he told him that scammers had gotten into his bank account and he needed help in catching the bad guys. The man and his wife agreed to withdraw $43,000 from their bank account and then drive to Tucson and hand it over to two FBI agents to use in a sting operation outside of a motel. The man was so convinced he was going to help bring down bad guys that he continued to wait even when the agents weren't on time. It was only when a motel employee heard the story and then expressed fear that they were being set up to be robbed that the man and his wife returned to Green Valley and called the Pima County Sheriff's Department. The man's brush with fraudsters was just one of the stories that were shared on Thursday during a Pima County Sheriff's Auxiliary Volunteer Fraud presentation that was hosted by the Green Valley Council. SAV member Steve Swallow said that the man still gets calls from the agent, but now he knows not to answer them. "Don't answer the phone and hang up the phone," were two of the big lessons Swallows and fellow SAEV member Rob Clark tried to teach on Thursday. Thanks to artificial intelligence and other technology, the bad guys have become really good at spoofing phone numbers, cloning voices, and creating stories that use the information that they've obtained from your social media accounts and the internet. You may think you're getting a call from the sheriff's department because it says so on your phone. And you may think that you're talking to a real deputy. But you may be actually talking to a bad guy that's sitting in Dubai using a real deputy's voice. And just because the man on the other end of the phone needing money because his car is broken down in Mexico sounds like your grandson Jimmy doesn't mean it really is Jimmy. If you don't recognize the number on your phone, the man said the best thing to do is to let it go to voicemail. And if you do answer the phone, hang up, because they only need seconds to clone your voice to use it for nefarious reasons. The man had similar advice for you when you get unexpected emails. If an email asks you to click on a link or call a specific number, don't. Instead, do your own research. Find a legitimate phone number for the organization that's emailed you in order to verify that they really are trying to reach you. Clark said he had a close call that could have been disastrous. He said it's his habit to check on his bank account every morning, but one morning he decided to check out his Facebook page first. After being kicked out of Facebook and changing his password a couple of times, it suddenly dawned on him someone might be watching his every move. Sure enough, when he took his computer to the Apple store, the employees confirmed that he must have clicked a link that gave the bad guys the ability to see his every keystroke. He had checked on his bank account that morning. They would have gained access to it had he done so. Clark and Swallow said people always need to be on alert for scams, and when someone is trying to rush you into doing something, it's a major red flag. If they're trying to scare you, it's a red flag, and if somebody wants you to use cryptocurrency, that's a real another red flag, he said. Clark told the crowd that Green Valley residents almost fell for a scammer who had convinced him he might go to jail for missing jury duty if he didn't deposit some money into a Bitcoin machine at the sheriff's department. On his way there, the scammer said the machine had broken down and that he needed to go to a K Circle store instead, Clark said. And then dawned on the man that it had to be a scam, since the deputy should have said Circle K. Green Valley Council Executive Director David McAllister Romo also spent time educating people about the home title fraud on Thursday. Bad guys are now looking for homes that are paid off, in trusts or seasonal, so that they can go to the county recorder's office with fraudulent documents saying the home has been deeded to them. Once the paper is filed with the recorder's office and the assessor's office, the bad guy can then refinance the house, put it up for sale, change beneficiaries in the trust, or engage in rental fraud schemes. McAllister Romo said the bad guys are targeting unencumbered homes and the others because they are not monitored closely. He urged residents to check on the status of their homes with the recorder's office and to sign up for the county's Fraud Notify program, which will alert you if changes are made to your deed after the fact. He and GVC President Debbie Kenyon also urged the crowd to sign their petition, which urges legislators to implement laws to make it harder for such scammers. Homeowners can also protect themselves by consistently monitoring their credit or freezing their credit, Romo said. If you start getting contacted by realtors wanting to sell your home, that could mean your deed has been transferred. Another red flag is if you start getting mail about home equity lines of credit. The forum was so well attended, Kenyon said another one will have to be scheduled in the very near future. Freeport-McMoRan announced on Wednesday 8 grants totaling $500,000 are headed to Green Valley and Suarita area organizations. Freeport's foundation awarded $3 million to 68 projects across 12 communities in Arizona, Colorado, Iowa, New Mexico, and Texas. Freeport said more than $6.8 million has been awarded through the Freeport-McMoRan Foundation Community Investment Fund in Green Valley and Suarita since 2012. So here are the 2025 fund awardees. The United Community Health Center, $30,000. SUSD Educational Enrichment Foundation Dyslexia Program, K-12, $39,000. $40,000 to the Suarita Food Bank. $50,000 to SUSD SHS Athletic Training Center. The Sheriff's Auxiliary Volunteers in Green Valley, $55,000. Continental Elementary School District, $75,000. And Green Valley Suarita Chamber of Commerce Foundation, $103,000. And Santa Rita Fire District, $108,000. Last year, close to 200 firefighters and family members between Golder Ranch and Nogales received potentially life-saving help thanks to the Greater Tucson Fire Foundation. The GTFF was created in 2010 to help firefighters address the top reasons that they lose their lives: heart issues, cancer, and mental health. Santa Rita Fire District spokeswoman Amy Schultz recently made a YouTube video hoping to raise support for the organization, which helps firefighters from 19 agencies, including SRFD and several in Santa Cruz County. Over the last 16 years, Schultz said the foundation has invested more than $1 million in firefighter health using money raised during fundraising efforts, donations, and a resale store that has since closed. Michael McKendrick, who retired from the Tucson Fire Department in 2011 after 32 years of service, is one of the founders of the foundation. As an assistant fire chief, he said it was one getting beat up when firefighters didn't come to work. There were various reasons for not coming to work, including health and wellness and mental health, he said. And at the time, mental health wasn't something that you really talked about. Back then, McKendrick said the fire agencies took great care of their fire engines, but not their firefighters, and that it was really costing them money. Slowly, however, as the different generations have retired, people did begin to talk about mental health issues out of necessity, McKendrick said. When firefighters came on the job now, they learn about mental health. They're told it's not a bad word, or two bad words, or a hyphenated word, and it's important. Many agencies have implemented, that is, mental health check-ins. All this because every day, firefighters deal with things most people rarely encounter, like serious injuries or death on the job, civilian deaths, mass casualty events, suicides, gruesome scenes, incidents involving children, hostile or dangerous situations, and prolonged rescue efforts that maybe have not been successful. More firefighters die annually by their own hands than in fires, Executive Director Rory Johnson said. Thanks to the foundation, firefighters can now get help with copays. Last year, firefighters got to spend 1,700 clinical hours with therapists who are firefighter savvy, Johnston said. They understand the lifestyle of a firefighter. They understand critical incidents, and they're geared to respond with that firefighter in a way that makes sense so that the firefighter can come directly to the therapist who is not associated with the fire department at all. They're off campus, they're off the line of duty, and they can meet with them on a very confidential level and see and receive care that is poignant to their lifestyle. By taking care of firefighters, the foundation is taking care of the community, said Board Chairman Dominic Worrell. When the tone goes off, when I call 911, I don't want them being hesitant. I don't want them wondering if they're okay to respond to a call. There's always been a stigma with them seeking care, and that's been true both physically and mentally. And I think both are improving over time, but there's still room to go with that. No one's too embarrassed that they have an ankle sprain, but to admit that you're considering self-harm or that you are depressed is a lot harder. Over the years, five agencies have learned a lot about the links between fighting fires and cancer. In the early 1900s, firefighters thought the grit and ash that they accumulated on their skin and turnouts just showed what hard workers they were. But nowadays, firefighters know about carcinogens and work very hard to decontaminate themselves. They keep contaminated gear and tools out of their engine cabs and living quarters, quickly clean their gear with special cleaners, and use extraction systems to help keep their station air clean. Cancer is the number one killer of firefighters. The number one on-duty killer is cardiac, and cancer is such an insidious disease. It makes you suffer. It makes your family suffer before you die, McKendrick said. Firefighters not only used to worry about cancers caused by carcinogens, but now they need to worry about mutagenic, tetragenic, and epigenogenic issues. Mutagenic refers to chemical or physical agents that cause mutations in their DNA, which can lead to cancer or cell death. Tetragenic describes drugs, chemicals, and infections that can disrupt fetal development, cause birth defects and developmental abnormalities, and pregnancy lost. Epigenetic studies how environments can turn genes on and off, which can affect future generations. It's not just breathing in bad smoke, it's the total environment, McKendrick said. The foundation, through its Helping Every Responder Overcome program, can help firefighters cover the gap of expenses while they're not working, Johnson said. They also pay for 650 cancer screenings and look for early signs of 50 types of cancers instead of the normal 5, Johnson said. 50% of one small fire agency tested positive for cancer. While some turned out to be false positives, Johnson said that the 1,800 firefighters in the region began pushing with their unions for that type of testing happening on an annual basis. She had one dear friend who died of cancer 8 months after retiring, and if he had undergone such a screen, it might have been caught much earlier, she said. Who knows? He probably would still be here and enjoying his grandchildren, enjoying hunting with his children and being a snowbird. As for cardiac issues, the foundation provides ultrasounds and other cardiac screenings for at-risk firefighters and has helped 5 agencies purchase workout equipment. They also work with regional agencies in promoting fitness education, Wuerl said. The fire service tends to use what is called a peer fitness model, and so we've helped train firefighters to have some exercise background in order to be the ones to then help their fellow firefighters, you know, work out better, create good programs, and kind of establish the cardiovascular health so that they can hopefully be safer and healthier performing the job, Wuerl said. Coming up on 19 After. Meandering the Mesquite, the man behind the OK Corral shootout, Joseph Isaac Ike Clanton. This is part 2. After the West's most celebrated gunfight in October of 1881, the Cowboys, as they were known, did not leave the field of honor and then slink away. Instead, they mustered forces with crooked Sheriff Johnny Behan and attacked the Earps legally. Ike Clanton, who survived the gunplay by running away, swore out warrants naming the Earps and Holiday as murderers. Wyatt and Doc were jailed. Morgan and Virgil were bedridden from their wounds. The hearing produced one of the West's most celebrated and contentious outcomes. Wells Spicer presided. The prosecution relied heavily on Ike's testimony. Behan's testimony, though decidedly anti-Earp in sentiment, offered no proof. Wyatt was allowed to read an unchallenged statement. Both sides' presentations were laced with mendacity, but Ike's testimony was deemed preposterous by the sitting judge and proclaimed so in his verdict of dismissal of the charges. The Cowboys switched tactics and found a different venue, the nearby town of Contention. It was really a ruse to set up an ambush of the Earps. The plan was foiled when a large posse accompanied Wyatt et al. Charges were then dropped. That, however, was not the end of things. In late December, Virgil, recovered from his gunshot wound, was ambushed. His assailants, under the cover of dark, shotgunned him. They would lose the use of one arm from the wounds. Ike Clanton's hat was found on the scene. No doubt it flew off when he raced from the crime. Other cowboys provided testimony that Ike was with them in nearby Charleston. No arrests. Wyatt would assume that King's admission, or Virgil's commission, was a federal deputy marshal. More threats would follow. In March, Morgan Earp was assassinated. Again, the shots came from the dark through a window, killing him as he played pool. Wyatt had had enough. The warrants for the perpetrators were converted into hunting licenses by Wyatt and the Wells Fargo-funded posse. That is another story for another time. The cowboys were exterminated across Pima and Cochise counties, stalwarts Curly Bill and Frank Stillwell among them, but not Ike. He and his brother Finn departed quickly to Apache County when their sister Mary resided with her husband Eben Stanley. Eben was an anachronism. He won the Medal of Honor in the Civil War. He also hung out with some local desperados. In no time, Ike and Finn were back in the stolen livestock business. And while the Earps were chased out of Arizona, Ike was back to his old tricks. The boys were targeted by Sheriff Commodore Perry Owens, a well-known gunfighter and lawman who carried a reputation not unlike Wild Bill Hickok. Ike and his mouth would continue to cause trouble and notoriety. He got into a fight with a Mexican named Romero over a card game in Springerville and then shot Romero. Ike then ran to the house of J.V. Brighton, who was a stock detective. It would prove to be an omen of things for Ike. Ike, however, ever the bullying coward, shoved a kid into an empty stove at a local store. The proprietor smacked him around and threw him out, and the incident made the local papers. Ike was also present when bad boy Lee Renfro killed a local rancher. As a result, Sheriff Commodore Owens put the Clantons at the top of the get-em list. On June of 1887, at the site of Peg Leg Wilson's crude cabin on Eagle Creek, Stock Detective Jonas V. Prighton killed Ike Clanton for money. There were conflicting accounts. One had Ike wheeling his horse around and reaching for a rifle. Years later, a report from a relative of a witness told that J.V. surprised Ike in bed and shot him unarmed. Both accounts have the bullet passing sideways through his torso and destroying his heart along the way. Brighton, as previously mentioned, knew Ike well. Brother Phineas would serve time for wrestling, but Renfro was killed. For whatever reasons, mostly curiosity, the author has sought the gravesites of Tombstone's notables. Curly Bill's proved elusive, though it is probably located at the confluence of the Babo Camari and San Pedro Rivers on the old Patterson Ranch site. A search for Ike's was a barren effort as well. A retired former lawman gave the late Glenn Boyer a map of Ike's grave location. Boyer, in turn, gave it to me with the instruction to look for the color yellow. He was not describing gold. Back in 1938, when President Roosevelt realized that the United States was probably going to end up fighting a war in Europe, America had only had two Army Air Corps training facilities for pilots, and the Air Corps had fallen to 19th in size globally. According to historian Steve Hoza, Roosevelt tasked General Henry Hap Arnold with rebuilding the Corps, and Arnold started out contracting with civilians. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7th of 1941, the U.S. went into overdrive. In a matter of months, pilots, bombardiers, and gunners were being trained at 50 sites across Arizona. Hoza spent an hour talking about those training sites at St. Francis in the Valley Episcopal Church on Tuesday as part of the History All Around Us speaker series that is hosted by the Santa Cruz Valley Historical Society. The Phoenix resident and his late brother Mike spent a year flying all over the state, documenting and photographing the sites. Their father John was stationed at Kingman Army Airfield and Yucca Army Airfield during World War II, and their uncle, Bill Manifold, was an 8th Air Force pilot who was shot down while on a raid over Schweinfurt, Germany, and crashed in Sweden. His uncle gifted him almost 1,000 photos that he took during the war. Many of them were seen in Hoza's presentation on Tuesday. Hoza told the group that Arizona Senator Carl Hayden was instrumental in getting so many air bases built in Arizona. He went before Congress and said that Arizona is the best place in the country to teach somebody how to fly, Hoza said. During peacetime, it would often take a year or two to build an airfield because of the various wind studies that had to take place first. During World War II, many were built in as few as 3 months. Cadets came from all over the United States, Great Britain, and China to train at the bases. Hoza showed photos of training facilities in and around Kingman, Williams, Yuma, Douglas, Tucson, Marana, Wickenburg, Phoenix, and Scottsdale, including Davis-Monthan in Tucson and Ryan Airfield just west of Green Valley. The Ryan PT-22 flew out of Ryan Airfield, Hoza said. These were very, very rudimentary airplanes. They had no electrical system, so they had to be hand-cranked to start, and they had no radios, he said. To speak with the cadet, the instructor had to speak into Gosport tubes, two rubber tubes connected to the cadet's helmet. The instructors that I talked to all said the engine made so much noise that they had to almost put an idle for the student to be able to hear him through the headsets, Hoza said. Davis-Monthan, which became an Army airfield in September of 1940, was the third largest B-24 training base in the nation. When the B-24s were replaced in 1945, DM became the only base to train B-29 pilots, Hoza said. The training was so rushed during the war years, he said that 15,000 men and women died in training accidents, 500 of those deaths right here in Arizona. Hoza shared an Arizona Republic story about a 19-year-old cadet dying in a mid-air collision in Marana. He also spoke about a British cadet who slammed into Roosevelt Lake while doing aerobatics. He also spoke a little-known incident in which a motorist was struck and killed and almost decapitated by an airplane flying too low outside of Wickenburg. They found propeller cuts in the asphalt, according to Hoza. Both men were tried and convicted of murder. One was tried at Williams, one was tried at Marana, and then a petition went up in Phoenix to grant them clemency, and they were both released, Hoza said. The Brits left their fallen cadets in the U.S., but all of the Chinese pilots who died were taken home, Hoza said. Most of the mechanics then were women, Hoza noted. On March 10th, Jerry Bryant will speak about WASPs, or the Women's Air Force Service Pilots. Those 1,100 women ferried aircraft from factories to bases, flew target tow planes, and transported dignitaries around, among other things, Hoza said. So what's next? Jerry Bryant will give a presentation on WASPs, World War II Women Air Force Service Pilots, at 10 a.m. on March 10th at St. Francis in the Valley Episcopal Church, and that is located at 600 South La Cañada. The event is part of Santa Cruz Valley Historical Society's History All Around Us speaker series, and you can learn more at santacruzvalleyhistory.org. And that, my friends, is the reading of the Green Valley News for Monday. Mark DeGroft with you. Stay tuned for more Sun Sounds programming. I'll be back on Wednesday. Until then, take care.